Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. The Marco Island Historical Society has been trying for a quarter of a century to bring home, on loan anyway, a world-famous artifact first discovered on the island more than a century ago when anthropologist Frank Hamilton Cushing unearthed it in 1896 on what is now Marco Island. The key Marco cat is considered to be one of the finest pieces of pre-Columbian Native American art ever discovered in North America. It's about 6 inches tall, just a little under. It's carved from native hardwood. The charismatic feline statuette has captured the public's imagination since its discovery, and it will go on display starting this Saturday, January 26th, along with other important pieces, including a ceremonial mask, an alligator figurehead, a painted human figure, and a sea turtle figurehead. The Marco Island Historical Society is putting on the exhibit in collaboration with the Collier County Museums, the Smithsonian Institution, and the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. Joining me now to discuss the exhibit and this famous carved cat in particular is Austin Bell. He is curator of collections at the Historical Society. So, Mr. Bell, thanks so much for coming into the studio today.
Thanks for having me.
If you'd like to add your voice to our conversation, you can give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. So let's go all the way back to the beginning of our awareness of the cat. How was it first found?
So in 1896, an anthropologist named Frank Hamilton Cushing journeyed down to Marco Island on an expedition sponsored jointly by the University of Pennsylvania and the Smithsonian Institution to explore archaeological finds on Marco Island on the property of W.D. Collier, who was one of the first pioneer settlers in the area. And so he was down here for several months and actually began uncovering from the muck these extraordinary artifacts made of wood and plant fiber and other materials that don't ordinarily survive in archaeological contexts.
Did he just happen to look at a map and go, oh, hey, I'm just going to head down to Marco Island? Or had he been tipped off that some stuff might be there?
He had actually been tipped off by another gentleman, a British lieutenant colonel named Colonel Durnford. And he was exploring, actually tarpon fishing, vacationing in the area in 1895. Heard about these. He was an amateur archaeologist. Went to Collier's property, pulled some artifacts out of the ground, then decided to take them to the University of Pennsylvania to show his friend who was a curator there. But when he got there, his friend wasn't there, and Cushing was, because Cushing was visiting his physician, Dr. Pepper, who worked at the university.
Dr. Pepper.
Yes. And so –
who later came to bring us soda. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And so actually on his physician's recommendation, he traveled to Florida because he was – known for being rather sickly, and so they thought it would help ail his physical ailments would improve if he were sent to Florida to explore this archaeological site. And Durnford then donated his finds to the British Museum, so there are actually items from the Marco Island at the British Museum now. And then that spurred Cushing to take his reconnaissance mission in 1895 and then followed up with a more detailed excavation in 1896.
Okay. So that's how they ended up getting there. Was anybody there that was Native American anymore, long gone?
The Seminole and Miccosukee lived in this part of Florida at that time. But on Marco Island, no, it was the homesteaders, Collier and his family and others, that lived in a village called Marco. At the time, there were two villages on Marco Island, Marco on the north end and Caxambas on the south end.
Caxambas. So how did it get the name Marco?
That's a good question, actually. I don't know the answer to that, but it might be, I would postulate, from Spanish origin, the conquistadors exploring this area beginning in the early 1500s probably has its origins in that.
Yeah, I could see that. And then Caxambas with the use of the letter X, that's kind of a Spanish thing too in a lot of certain areas.
And that's one of the oldest place names that appears on early maps of Collier County or what is now Collier County is Caxambas, or which meant fresh water or fresh wells. And there were rumors of fresh drinking water on Marco Island.
Huh. So how much archaeology was going on before development really got going in earnest down in Marco Island? I mean, has everything been overturned and looked at? I mean, is there stuff still to be found maybe?
Well, the thing about Cushing's find is that archaeology as a discipline was really still in its infancy at the time in 1896. So a lot of the procedures that you would do now were not done at the time. It was really just come down, collect everything that you could in as short a period of time as you could. They didn't necessarily document the stratigraphy or the detailed context surrounding the artifacts. They just recovered it all and then took it back to the museum.
They didn't say we found this 6 inches under or a foot deep.
Only and very select. They found hundreds and hundreds of artifacts, and only for very select few did they provide any additional context. And so, you know, in the years since the Antiquities Act, I believe it was 1906, and other protections around archaeological sites and cultural and historical resources have come into place where this sort of excavation wouldn't have happened the way it did at that time. But for the next 50 years or so, a lot of the archaeological sites were just raised or middens were raised, and the shell was actually used to pave roads on the island for automobiles as they came in. And so a lot of the archaeological sites were destroyed or altered in some way. But there are still some intact deposits under the ground. And even now with the cultural resource requirements, if, for example, a sewer pump is put in Old Marco, it's a known archaeological site. So then they have to have an archaeologist come out and survey the area and do test excavations, and sometimes they find things, and that's actually where we get a lot of our collections now at the museum, is from the results of those surveys, and then the landowners donate them to the museum. So,
I know we had that tree that fell over from Irma.
That's right, yes, and that pulled up Colusa artifacts with it as well. And so the fascinating thing about our exhibit at the Marco Island Museum is that it takes these artifacts that were excavated from what is essentially the same site that Cushing excavated more than 100 years earlier, with artifacts that are being pulled out of the ground now as part of these cultural surveys of the area. And they're probably loosely associated at the very least, but from the same known archaeological site excavated more than a century apart by totally different, you know, techniques and requirements.
That's pretty fascinating. So would you consider the entire island of Marco Island to be a known archaeological site?
Well, there are specific parts of Marco Island that are actually, you know, on the Florida Master Site file. And so the north and south ends in particular are known for being large shell mound complexes. And Goodland on the east end, which is actually independent, Collier County fishing village on the end of Marco Island, is a known archaeological site as well. But there are probably little scatters here and there across the island.
So at what point did they figure out that the items that they were unearthing were that old? Did they know that this was from all the way back to the Colusa?
I think they knew immediately that what they were finding was from some culture or society that long predated them on the island. I'm not sure they necessarily instantly equated it with the Colusa. Cushing was an anthropologist who actually did more ethnography than archaeology. And so he worked a lot with the Zuni out in the southwest. But he began to prepare reports about his discoveries in the years, you know, following, and did start making some of those connections, but unfortunately passed away in 1900 at the age of 42. And so he never really – yeah. And he never got to really fully publish the results that he wanted to.
I don't want to besmirch the good name of Dr. Pepper, but maybe he needed a different cure than just coming down to Florida.
Well, he sure did work hard when he sent him down here.
He sure did.
And the mosquitoes, you know, and the heat. So
yeah. So who – tell me a little bit about the Colusa Indians and what we know about them. From what I have gathered in the years of being here, we don't know a whole lot.
That's right. And, you know, archaeology, we learn a little bit more bit by bit. And I'm not an archaeologist, so I'm speaking on, you know, behalf of what other archaeologists.
Yeah, I'm an amateur archaeologist too. I used to dig up arrowheads when I was a kid. So,
but the Colusa, you know, from what we know from archaeology and ethnohistoric accounts, particularly from the Spanish, were a powerful society that controlled pretty much all of South Florida by the time Europeans first arrived in Florida. And they lived here for thousands and thousands of years, they and their ancestors. You know, the Colusa capital was on what is now Mound Key in Estero Bay. And they're one of the only societies known to have developed such a level of sophistication and complexity without a principal reliance on agriculture. And the reason for that is that the environment around them provided them with the natural resources they needed to not only survive but to thrive, and that came mostly from fishing and shellfish.
Has anything been found similar to this? I mean, I know we're talking about the cat and these this particular Marco Island area. Did anything like that ever get dug up on Mauna Kea?
Actually, I think in recent archaeological excavations by University of Florida, University of Georgia, they were able to find some trace evidence of fishing net, plant fiber materials. It's extraordinarily rare in archaeological contexts again. But
it's just amazing that would even survive.
That's right. Yeah, for hundreds if not thousands of years. And at the Randell Research Center, which is run by the University of Florida, they've found some wooden artifacts as well, a crane figurehead and some plant fiber, but nothing still even more than 100 years later to the extent and, you know, just amazing artistry that was found at the Key Marco site. That's still kind of, you know, the thing that everyone hopes to find.
So I'm imagining this group of people, the Calusa Indians, and I'm wondering, why would they sit down and whittle a cat? Is there any reason? Was this home decor object? Was this a ritual object? Was it ceremonial? Is there any knowledge about why that existed, why they would go to the trouble to carve? And it was painted, from what I understand, too.
Well, the short answer to that is no, we don't know. And the cat actually wasn't painted, but several of the artifacts that are on display next to the cat in the museum were painted, and there's still trace evidence of the pigment on there. And, you know, again, we don't know much about why they might have made this, but a lot of speculation is that it was of religious or ceremonial importance, and that's based partly on those Spanish accounts that describe in their meetings with the Calusa religious processions from a temple of the idols, and the people in the procession were described as wearing face masks, mm-hmm. And the idols are often assumed to be these animal figureheads and carvings, such as the Key Marco cat.
So it's kind of a little guy, though. So I mean, in the procession, it would he's a.
That's right. We don't know. Was it worn as part of a larger
maybe
apparatus?
Maybe it was part of a headdress or something like that.
Or handheld, or it just sat on, you know, a piece of furniture in the home. So, again, yeah, it could have just been, you know, a piece of furniture too, for all we know.
And, yeah, it could have been part of like an armrest.
Yes. Yeah. So there's really not much we're certain about, but there's certainly a lot of ideas out there about what it could be.
Okay, and I'm wondering now, what kind of cat is it? So, I mean, did they have house cats or chicky cats back then, or would it have been a wild cat, like a bobcat or a Florida panther?
I think it's mostly assumed to be either a Florida panther or a bobcat, but if you look closely, especially at the back of it, it has this long, beautiful tail that extends all the way up to the back of its neck, and most reasonably, I think, could be associated with the Florida panther.
Yeah, I'm going to go with panther, I think. Yeah. But you said some people said it looks like a squirrel.
That's right. My sister-in-law thinks it could be the Key Marco squirrel. So I'm actually not sure what squirrels were native to the area at that time. But, you know, just because we say it's one thing, you know, another person might see it as something else. So we're open to different interpretations at the museum, and we're pretty transparent in all of our object labels and interpretation that we really don't know what this is, but here's what we do know.
Okay, so the reason we don't know is because it's so old, and it's described as one of the finest pieces of pre-Columbian art ever found in North America. Can you tell me what pre-Columbian means for listeners who might not otherwise know?
So pre-Columbian just refers to the period in time before the Europeans first really invaded the continent, beginning with the Spanish in Florida in 1513 when Juan Ponce de León first explored the area. And one of the reasons we don't know how old these artifacts are exactly, and I talked a little bit about it before, but archaeology at that time wasn't as detailed and complex as it is today. Radiocarbon dating didn't exist. So, you know, radiocarbon dating was done on the artifacts actually about 70 years after they were excavated. But during those decades, the museums actually applied pesticides and other poisonous materials to artifacts to help preserve them. And some have argued that those could have altered the radiocarbon dates. And
so it's not trusted?
Not necessarily trusted. And so you have this huge range of dates too with the radiocarbon dates that came back. And so at the museum, we interpret them as either being from 500 to 1500 years old. And the reason we start at 500 is because there were no European artifacts found at the site, which makes it predate Spanish arrival and going back to the pre-Columbian idea.
But it could be all the way back to 1500 years ago.
It could be. And it could even be older than that.
That's pretty incredible. And now it's sitting there at the Marco Historical Society.
That's right. And again, you know, these are items made of wood, which is just, you know, you think about a piece of wood sitting outside in the Florida heat and humidity, surviving for centuries, the chances of that happening, it was just sealed in this oxygen-free layer of muck at the archaeological site where it was just preserved in the bacteria that would ordinarily, decay these artifacts, just wasn't able to exist.
We have a call coming in from Paul in Punta Gorda. Paul, what would you like to ask about?
Yeah, this is fascinating. Years ago, I used to do exhibits, and down in Punta Gorda, we had a little museum, the Florida Adventure Museum, and one of our patrons had carved the Key Marco cat, and what a beautiful job he did. He made it about 2 feet high, and we used that for an exhibit. But over the years, I've been all over Charlotte Harbor and the Peace River, and you always see these little bits of sand paste pottery. And I got a bunch of it bagged up once, and I sent it to the University of Florida. I want to say it was a Dr. Hunsinger. I'm not sure. It's been back in the 80s. And when they carbon dated it, he was nice enough to send us a letter back and said it was, I think they said it was 1500, between 500 and 1500 BC. There was some other items in there, even some pieces of bone, which I thought were a fish bone. And he said, or the research said, it was a pre-Calusa aboriginal water-based culture. And I think you were starting to say a little bit about that, and I'll hang up and listen. But what do they know about that?
Okay, thanks, Paul. That's a good question. Do they know much about a pre-Calusa water-based group?
Yeah, I believe the period that you're referring to, if it's 500 BC and even earlier, is actually known to archaeologists as the Archaic period. And so those people could or could not be direct descendants of the Calusa. We know even less about them because it was even longer ago. But the Archaic period in Florida saw the first introduction of pottery. And so they started with this fiber-tempered pottery. And that's really one of the things that distinguishes Archaic period from Glades or Calusa periods is the temper they used. The Archaic is predominantly fiber-tempered pottery, and then the sand-tempered pottery comes in, which this gentleman was just mentioning. And then the diversity of even the pottery types of designs and decorations that you see varies from Marco Island to Mound Key, which is just 30 miles north. And so you see a lot of unique Glades-type decorations on pottery found on Marco Island that you might not see as much further north. And we actually had some vessels that we found from the Key Marco site, again, associated loosely with these Cushing artifacts, and also sent them to the University of Florida, where Ann Cordell, who's a ceramic technologist there, reconstructed them for us. And so now we have these beautiful large ceramic vessels almost fully reconstructed on display in the museum with these Cushing artifacts. And they were able to carbon date food residue that was scraped from the interior surface of those vessels. They dated to about 600 to 700 AD, which falls in that time range of the Cushing dates.
Okay, but that would still be pre-Calusa.
That actually would be, yeah. I mean,
beginning of Calusa?
That wouldn't be in the Archaic period, which this gentleman was talking about.
I just think it's fascinating because, to steal a word from our caller, fascinating because it seems like the popular notion of the entire history of Florida gets to Calusa and that's pretty much it. But there were people before the Calusa in our area that I don't think we'd really hear much about.
Right. I mean, going back thousands and thousands of years when the peninsula was twice as wide as it is today, and if you go before the Archaic Indians, they're what archaeologists term the Paleo Indians, were really the first people known to settle in Florida. And it seems every few years they're making a new discovery, especially up in the Panhandle area. that pushes that first date even further and further back. I think it's more than 14,000 years now, because a lot of those early sites are now inundated underwater as sea levels rose, and they reached modern conditions really about 5,000 years ago. But they're, you know, going back 14,000 years, there's a lot of sites off the coast that show evidence of the first human activity in Florida.
We've had a few stories on before about the sea level rise and how that is swallowing up some of these coastal artifacts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's something interesting that archaeologists are looking at too, even with the Colusa and how they adapted, because, you know, it's not as if the sea level just rose all at one time to a level and then stayed that way for, you know, 1,000 years. It came in and it went out, and they moved, depending on water levels and the environment around them and the estuaries. I mean, they were very in tune with their surroundings and adapted to it. As part of the thousands of years of occupation of this area. So they, you know, dealt with that just as we do today.
We could probably take a few lessons.
I would think so. especially about sustainability.
And being in tune with what's going on. Do you remember the first time you saw this cat in person?
I do. I went to the Smithsonian Institution in 2014 in December. It was just before the holidays, and I just met with their staff and their conservator to really get the ball rolling on this loan and talk about the requirements necessary. And there were quite a few.
For you to be able to bring it back for a visit?
That's right. Yeah, especially security and environmental conditions. But I just remember they pulled it out of the drawer, and it has this beautiful little box with very plush-looking pillows that it rests on. And they took it out and, you know, put the gloves on. And it was just – I mean, I just – you know, I was almost overcome with emotion just seeing it in person, you know, for the first time.
So when you were transporting it, how much bubble wrap did you have to go through?
Actually, no bubble wrap.
Okay.
They built a special crate. It's actually an extraordinarily large crate for how small the artifact is. And it's, you know, just, I mean, the detail in the foam, they carved everything, little deposits in the foam for the artifact, but also all the little accessories and the mounts that came with it, and shipped it overnight. And
were you nervous?
I was a little nervous just because it was the culmination of so many years.
You'd worked really hard. We've been doing stories on this for the last 2 years about the possibility this is going to actually happen, and now it's happened.
Yeah.
But when it was in transport, were you just biting your nails?
Well, not really, because they're so well qualified. We had special art shippers, you know, handling it, and then the Smithsonian.
Did you go like UPS or U.S. Postal Service?
No, but actually, you know, I don't want to get too off topic, but do you know that the Hope Diamond, when it was sent to the Smithsonian, was actually just sent in postal mail. Somebody put some stamps on an envelope and dropped it in the mailbox. And so we joked a lot about that with the cat, but of course did not pursue that route. But
not the pursue the route you
No,
pursue.
But the Smithsonian came down with the artifact. And so, you know, they knew what they were doing. They do this all the time. And so they made the process very easy for us and stress-free, relatively stress-free.
So interesting the difference in the way that the artifact is respected at this point, as opposed to how it was transported away from Marco Island.
Yes.
When Cushing got it, you know?
Yeah, it's just fascinating to think about. And then, you know, the change in the power that it holds as an object and how that differs probably from when, you know, its maker created it centuries ago to now, where it's, you know, bringing in thousands of people and generating, you know, by economic studies, millions of dollars for the county. And I just, you know, have to wonder what the person that made it originally would think to know that this their object is now in this museum and attracting so much attention.
There would be a lot of catching up for that, whoever carved that cat, to get their head around what's going on now.
Yeah.
So how long is it going to be there?
So it's going to be there for 2.5 years. It'll be on loan through April 2021.
That sounds like the last time I loaned a pan to my neighbor. I'm just kidding. So 2.5 years. So that's going to be generating a lot of traffic, I think, to you guys.
We hope so. Yeah. You know, we have the grand opening this Saturday at the museum from 9 to 4. And people have already – the word's gotten out that it's there, and our crowds have already just grown in size even before the official opening. So we're very excited.
Well, that's great. And the grand opening coming up this Saturday. I want to thank my guest, Austin Bell. He's the curator of collections at the Marco Island Historical Society. Mr. Bell, thanks so much for sharing your time and historical knowledge with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. This was great.
And thanks to our earlier guest, political science professor Aubrey Jewett from the University of Central Florida. Our show today was produced by Mike Kinnairy, John Davis, and myself. Our director is Mike Kinnairy. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.